This is the Physics 114 lecture for February 5th, 2015. If you haven't already, please download the slides that will accompany the lecture on the class website. The first thing I want to mention is that we have our first midterm exam on February 12th. It will take place in Hoyt, and it will take place during the normal lecture time. I sent out an email to this effect, and I talked about what we'll cover in that email, but just to mention it here as well. The material we'll cover through the end of Gauss's Law material, which is in this lecture at the bottom of page 5. And it will also cover material on workshops 1 and 2 and problem sets 1 through 3, as well as material in chapters 21 and 22 of the textbook. In terms of some of the logistical details of the exam, I allow you to bring in an 8.5 by 11 inch sheet of paper. So this would be on slide 2. An 8.5 by 11 inch sheet of paper where you can write anything you'd like on one side of it. You can put formulas, you can put example problems, you can put prayers, you can do whatever. I do ask that you, when I say it's one side of an 8.5 by 11 inch sheet of paper, I mean not topologically enhanced. It may sound incredible, but it is very true. Once I walked into class and a student had taped a series of index cards to the sheet of paper so that they were flaps, and he had increased the surface area several fold by using these flaps and considered that to be one side of the 8.5 by 11 inch sheet of paper. That's not cool. Please don't do that. So no topological enhancements. I will also include a formula sheet with the exam that has basic formulas. I'm not interested in you memorizing formulas. I'm more interested in thinking your way through problems and figuring out how to solve them. You should bring a scientific calculator. You need something that does sines and cosines. If your scientific calculator has superpowers and graphing and all that kind of stuff, basically you need to show me how you get what you got, even if you can just say answer number 3 to your calculator and have it pop out the answer. If you just write down an answer, it is wrong in this class unless I tell you otherwise in the specific problem. You must show your work. You must show your work because we do give lots of partial credit. So partial credit is a two-edged sword. If you write down an answer without showing me how you got it, then you don't get credit for it. I would like you to use a pen on the exam. There are previous exams for Physics 114 which are available for you to review and study. You can find a link on the class website, and there you will find a file which is blank, just the exam, and a file which is the exam with the solutions written on them, so you can use them as practice exams if you want. Let's see, I believe I probably will assign a problem set 4, which will be due on the 13th, which is the day after the exam. I know most of you, if not all of you, will need to be studying for the exam right up until that Thursday and won't be in the mood to do a whole lot of physics Thursday night. I relate to that. So on the other hand, I don't want you to get too far behind. So if I give you a problem set due on the 13th, it will be quite short. It's possible I'll decide just to delay it a week. I don't know yet. It is Tuesday morning here in Japan. It's Monday evening for you, so there's time to think about that on my part. Okay, so if you have detailed questions about, if you have issues, questions about how the exam will run, feel free to email me. Let's go to slide 3. So last time we talked quite a bit about Gauss's Law, and I would like to do one more example for you before we move on to other topics. Let's imagine that we have a non-conducting rod which is infinite in length, and it has a radius, big R, and it has a charge which is distributed as a function of R. So that is the charge density, the volume charge density, rho, is equal to some constant, which I'm calling A, times the radius. And that will be true for little r less than big R. So that's inside this non-conducting rod. Let's say that the charge per unit length is given by constant lambda. And then the question, the problem, is what is the electric field for R, which is less than big R? And I guess we might also ask, what is the electric field for little r bigger than big R? So the, between the two of them, we have the electric field in all space. But for now, let's look at R less than big R. So suppose that we are somehow are able to look at the, we can cut this rod and look at it from the end. So pretend your eyeball is where I have a Roman numeral 1. And from that point of view, what you see is the view that I have drawn at Roman numeral 2. And what we would like to do is to consider, we want to find the electric field for little r less than big R. And to do this, because we have the cylindrical symmetry in the problem and there's no angular dependence, we can imagine that we have a Gaussian surface which is, also has cylindrical symmetry with the same axis of symmetry. And let us assume this Gaussian surface has a radius which is little r, which is smaller than big R. So if you look where the Roman numeral 2 is and the little sketch to the right, you can imagine what the Gaussian surface in pink looks like. Let us assume that this Gaussian surface has a length L. You may worry about this because where did this L come from? And you need it because you have to have a closed Gaussian surface. The rod is infinite in length, so it may concern you that we have a Gaussian surface that has just a length L. But in the end, what you'll find is this length L will cancel out. So we're just going to carry it for now because we have to have a closed surface. So at the bottom of slide 3, we have Gauss's law stated, and Gauss's law is always true. So we know that the integral of E dot dA over this surface, this pink Gaussian surface that we have imagined in this problem, is equal to Q enclosed inside that Gaussian surface divided by epsilon naught. Let's go to slide 4. Now on slide 4, I have at the top, where I have Roman numeral 1, the left-hand side of Gauss's law actually expanded out. So Gauss's law says the integral over the entire surface of the Gaussian surface, E dot dA, and what I have written on the top of slide 4 is I've broken that surface down into three parts. One is one of the end caps, that's the first term. The second term is the other end cap, and the third term is the cylindrical pipe region. So beneath each of these terms, I have drawn the part of the Gaussian surface, in this case in green, that each of these individual integrals correspond to. So if you look where I have the Roman numeral 2, you can see the end cap region that represents, as represented by the first integral up at the top of slide 4. And in this case, this is the end cap. So n hat is given by the orange vector going to the left on that piece of the end cap. That is the end cap. Remember, n hat is the vector at right angles to the surface. In this case, the surface is the end cap, and so the n hat is at right angles to that. By the symmetry in the problem, if we imagine the electric field due to any of the charge that's inside this Gaussian surface, it has to be radial. And that will be basically parallel to the surface of the end cap. So what this means is that at every point on this end cap, the electric field and the n-hat, or the da, if you will, are at right angles to one another. So e dot da is going to be 0. So that first integral, the first term in the expression at the top of slide 4 is 0, because e dot da is 0. Similarly, on the second term, I've drawn below the dA vector, or the n-hat vector, if you wish, which is orange. And again, it is at right angles to the electric field, which has to be in the radial direction due to the symmetry of the problem. So e dot dA is 0. The third term, this is not going to be 0. N-hat is going to be radially outward along all around the pipe, and the electric field is also radially outward all around the surface of the pipe. So E dot dA is equal to the magnitude of E times dA. The magnitude of E in this case is a constant at a given radius, because we have no angular dependence and the problem has radial symmetry. So the third term at the top expression on slide 4 becomes, if you look down in the middle of the page at the Roman numeral, slide 4, integral of E dot dA around the pipe becomes the magnitude of E times the integral of dA around the pipe. The integral of dA is just the surface area on the pipe, and that's going to be 2 pi r times the length of the pipe. You can think of that as thinking 2 pi r is the circumference of the pipe, and then I multiply it by the length of the pipe, and that gives me the total area of the pipe surface. So E times the integral of dA around the pipe surface becomes the magnitude of E times 2 pi r dL. I'm sorry, 2 pi r L. And then that is equal to the right-hand side of Gauss's law, which is Q enclosed over epsilon naught. So if I take this and I rewrite it down where I have a Roman numeral 5 at the bottom of the paper, the left-hand side is the same. It's E times 2 pi r L. The right-hand side, I now want to write Q enclosed as the total charge that's inside the Gaussian surface. To do that, that's the integral of rho dV, where the volume that you integrate over now is the volume of the Gaussian surface, because you want to know how much charge is inside that. The whole thing is over epsilon naught. This is a cylindrical problem, so I imagine that my differential volume is a cylindrical shell which has a radius of 2 pi r and a width you imagine that I have a pipe-like shape, which is 2 pi r in circumference times a length L, so that would be the area of the pipe, and then you imagine that it goes out a little dr thickness, and that would be my volume dV. Refer to last lecture if you want to get a feeling for how we're imagining this differential volume in a cylindrical problem. So the integral of rho dV becomes the integral of rho times 2 pi r L dr. Whole thing is over epsilon naught. 2 pi and L are all constants, and I want to integrate rho dr. Rho, I rewrite in terms of what it's given in the problem. It's not a constant in this particular problem, but it is a constant A times R squared. So I get 2 pi L over epsilon naught times the integral from 0 out to the radius of the Gaussian surface, because remember, it is only within the Gaussian surface that I'm trying to calculate this charge, of A times R squared dr. So if we go to slide 5, on slide 5, you can see in the middle of slide 5 the differential volume that we're considering. Okay, that's the 2 pi rl dr as expressed by Roman numeral 3. And you can see the arrow pointing to the volume that I'm referring to. So at the top of slide 5, we have the left-hand side of the integral is what it was, which is the magnitude of e times 2 pi r times l. The right-hand side is now has the 2 pi l over epsilon naught, and now I do the integral, and the integral of r squared dr is r cubed over 3. And evaluated between the limits of little r and 0, it becomes a times little r cubed over 3. So now I can take the expression where I have the Roman numeral 1, and I can actually solve for the magnitude of E. And the magnitude of E then will be A times R squared over epsilon naught times 3. Notice that the L is the length of the Gaussian surface, which one may have been worried about not knowing earlier, now cancels out because it comes into both the left-hand side and the right-hand side. So you should never let that stop you from doing one of these problems just because you don't know it. So that's the magnitude of E, and then by the symmetry of the problem, it is in the radial direction. If the charge that you have, which I think I specified earlier in the problem, is positive, then it will be out radially. And this will be the electric field for R less than big R. And in fact, I think for this example problem, that's the hard part, so that's the part that we'll do. If you're outside of this cylindrical rod, you'll find the field looks just like that of an infinite line charge. You can prove that to yourself. At any rate, this is now the end of material for exam 1. So let's now go to slide 6. The next topic that I would like to discuss is the concept of energy and potential energy, or often what we just call potential, in electrostatics. You may recall that in mechanics, when you started calculating problems with gravity, if you use the force of gravity times the distance through which something worked, the calculations could be rather difficult because a force is a vector and the force goes as a 1 over r squared and et cetera, and it's just sort of hard. And life became a lot simpler when you looked at energy considerations and you realized that gravity being a conservative force, meaning that the potential energy depended only on the endpoints of the motion, you could do things like calculate the energy a body would gain by moving down a distance h in a gravitational field. So the change in the potential energy was just mgh, and you could set that equal to the change in the kinetic energy and solve the problem. And so life became a lot easier. So it turns out that in electromagnetism we have a similar sort of thing. Remember, we've dealt with moving around charges due to in electric fields. So the electric field concept is nice, but it's still a vector. And if you want to understand energy in the electric field or in electrostatics, you want to move it around and look at how the force and the distance change as you move around. But it's a vector, so life is hard. So what I'd like to do is to step back and let's look at the energy of the system as we move a charge around. And we'll have to start out by thinking of it as a hard thing in the sense that we have to consider the force and the work that it takes to move a charge around, because that's how you think about energy. So let's imagine at the top of slide 6 that we have a positive point charge, which is the big Q. And let's imagine that we have a little positive test charge, little q, which we start out at a position A, which would be at a radius of little r sub a relative to the point charge q. And what I'd like to do is to just move along the radial direction this little charge q from the position A to the position B, which has a radius little r sub b. And the question I'd like to examine here is how much work does it take me to move the little charge Q from point A to point B? And to do this, what I'd like to do is to calculate that work, which means I want to calculate the integral as I go from point A to point B of F dot ds. Remember, ds is s is sort of the path length from where I start to where I end. Ds would be a differential part of that path length. and I'm actually moving along that path. So at any given little differential point of it, I have a little vector ds, and I'm exerting a force, which I'm exerting at that point ds in order to move the charge. And if you look where I have a Roman numeral 2 on the right-hand middle of this slide 6, you can see how the various quantities I might want to consider in this problem are oriented. I'm wanting to move the little charge Q in toward big charge Q, so the force I have to exert to do that is going to be inward along the radial direction, as the F vector shows in the picture in the middle of slide 6 on the right-hand side. I'm moving along a path ds, which is also toward toward big Q. The electric field from big Q is toward the right, that is, it's along the outward radial direction, and the radial vector dr is always going to be outward radially. So the relationship between ds and dr and f and e are shown in that little picture sketch in the middle of slide 6. So to start the calculation, let's go to the bottom of slide 6. The amount of work it takes to move from A to B is equal to F dot ds by definition. In this case, if you look at the problem, I am pushing it radially toward big Q, and ds is also toward big Q. So F dot ds are in the same direction, and both are radial, so the integral of f dot ds becomes the integral from a to b of f times ds. What is f? F is equal to, in magnitude, is equal to q times the magnitude of e. So I just rewrite the magnitude of f to be q times e, which would be the third term down, not term, but the third piece at the bottom of slide 6. ds is equal to minus dr. That is, if I am moving inward, ds is increasing as dr is decreasing, I guess is a way to say it. So ds is equal to minus dr. So I substitute in because I'm integrating in along the radial direction. So the integral of qe ds becomes minus the integral of qe times dr. Go to slide 7. I now substitute in for E, which is kqq over r squared, and I do the integral. The integral of 1 over r squared is minus 1 over r. The minus signs cancel. So in the middle term at the top of slide 7, you have kqq is times 1 over r evaluated between the limits of rb and ra. So I write that out down on the top of slide 7, the right-hand corner. The amount of work to go from A to B is equal to kqq over times 1 over rb minus 1 over ra. Now notice that the B position is at a smaller radius than the A position. So that means that 1 over ra, since ra is bigger, is going to be smaller numerically than 1 over RB. So this right-hand top expression, slide 7, has to be positive in this problem. And that's a good thing, and you should be happy to see that, because I know that I'm asking how much work do I do to push the charge in from position A to position B. And since I'm moving that positive test charge toward a positive particle, I know that I have to do work. It has to be net positive work. So this quantity needs to be algebraically positive. So if I just distribute the kqq, we get the expression by the Roman numeral 2 in slide 7, that the work it takes to go from A to B is equal to kqq over rb minus kqq over ra. The work per unit charge, so if I want to create a quantity that is independent of the magnitude of my test charge, then I get the expression where I have a Roman numeral 3. It's equal to kq times 1 over rb minus 1 over ra. And this is something which we define as the potential difference between A and B. Number two, by the Roman numeral 2, that is the difference in energy it takes to go from A to B. But notice it depends on what the test charge is, because I have to push harder if the test charge is big. So now what I'd like to do is to create a quantity, sort of like when we did the electric field, we divided out the charge to look at what is the effect on space due to the charge itself. Here we do the same thing. We divide out the little charge test Q, so we look at the energy per unit charge it takes to move from point A to point B. So this would be a change in energy that is sort of determined by big Q and has nothing to do with little Q test charge. And so this is what we call the potential difference in electricity. We use different symbols. Sometimes we call that a delta V. Sometimes it's a, you know, potential at point B minus potential at point A, or a V minus VA, VB minus VA. Sometimes it's signified as VAB, generally the potential difference. This is a work, because remember that what we have is a work dividing out a charge, so it's work per unit charge. And so the units necessarily are joules per coulomb in MKS. And that is a symbol which we define as the volt in electricity. So if you go to slide 8, that's named after this guy, Count Alessandro Giuseppe Antonio Anastasio Volta. And he's Italian from the 1800s, and he did a lot of experiments with this kind of stuff and deserves the credit at any rate. So that's where the word volt came from. So go to slide 9. So if I move this little test charge from A to B, and I look at the work per unit charge it takes to do that, then I get the potential difference, VAB is equal to KQ times 1 over RB minus 1 over RA. So notice that a couple of things, that this is just a difference in energy. So in mechanics, for example, you might talk about differences in height or change in height. If you want to know how much energy changes due to gravity, you look at the change in height, mg delta h, right? mgh, where h is the change in the height. So that change is what's important. If you're on the surface of the Earth, it is possible to talk about absolute height, but in order to do that, you have to define a proper zero. It's changes in height that are relevant for the energy change in problems, but sometimes we like to talk about absolutes. So there we might define, for example, the zero of height in any given system to be sea level. And so we can talk about height above sea level. Or in individual problems where you have sliding boards, for example, you might define the zero of height for the problem to be the bottom of the sliding board. And then from that scale, you can define the absolute height. In electricity, we do the same sort of game. What is usually important is the change in potential. That is the amount of work per unit charge that changes as you go from one point to another. Okay, that's what's really important. That said, it's very useful often to talk about the absolute energy or absolute potential energy of a certain point in space. That makes sense only if you define a zero. In electricity and magnetism, very, very often, but certainly not always, so always watch for this, it makes sense to define the zero of the potential to be at infinity. So if we do that, for example, if we define the potential to be zero as R is infinite, if we let the position A, the point A, to be out at infinity, then 1 over infinity is zero, and in doing that, we can define the absolute potential to be the potential at the point R sub B, or generically at the bottom of page 9, just the radius r, is just kq over r, where the kq over the infinity, or the kq over ra, if you will, disappears, because as r goes to infinite, r sub a goes to infinite, and that term goes to zero. So under the circumstances that you've defined the potential at infinity to be zero, you have defined an absolute potential, or an absolute potential energy, if you will, of a point of a point in space relative to a point charge q to be kq over r. What does that really mean? That means if I were to take a little charge, test charge q, and put it at position r, then it would take an amount of work per unit charge of kq over k big q over r to put the charge there. So if we look on slide 10, maybe you can see what I'm talking about a little bit. The potential at a point P in space is equal to kq over r if I've defined potential to be zero out at infinity. So if I want to move a charge q prime from infinity to the point P, it will be an amount of work per unit charge of k times big Q over r, or an amount of work, which will be k times q prime over r. Another thing to notice about all this is if you go and you look at what we did, for example, on slide 6, and you look at the answer that we get for that on slide 7, think about what's happening on slide 9. It's all sort of the same thing. This potential, this work per unit charge it takes to go from point A to B, depends only on the positions A and B. You notice in our calculation, we assumed that we were moving along the radial direction, but we did that for simplicity in thinking about the work. The truth is the answer, the amount of work per unit charge it takes to go from A to B, depends only on those endpoints, A and B. So this is really very similar to what we ran into with gravity. And that is, for example, gravity is a conservative force. That means that the change in energy only depends on the position. So if we have a frictionless sliding board in a gravitational problem, for example, the energy you have at the bottom, the kinetic energy, is the change in the potential energy. And that depends only on the change in the height, that is, the endpoints. So it doesn't matter what path you took to get there. So electricity is sort of the same thing. Well, it is the same sort of thing. And so electricity, or electrostatics, if we're on slide 10, it's a conservative force. And what we say is the potential difference between two points is path independent. Remember, potential difference is the work per unit charge it takes to go from one point to another. And what we're stating now is that as I go from one point to the other, that potential difference that I get, that is the work per unit charge it takes to go from one point to the other, doesn't care about what path I take to get there. This is very important, as it was in gravitation. So if we go to slide 11, at the top of slide 11, imagine that I have a conductor. Now remember that the electric field inside a conductor is zero. So that means if I have a charge at any point in that conductor and I try to move it to some other point in the conductor, because the electric field is zero, it means I can do it without exerting any force, because there is no other force on the charge. So we say that the conductor is at an equipotential, or it is an equipotential surface. It is all at one potential. It is all at one potential because I can move a charge from any point on it to any other point with no work per unit charge to do so. All right. So we have looked at the potential of a point charge, say on slide 10, the potential surrounding a point charge, say at point P, the potential at point P due to a single charge Q, given at a distance vector R from that point Q, is KQ over R. Note that it does not matter what the direction of Q is relative to point P. Note that I define, you know, where Q is relative to point P by some vector R, because it has a position in 3 space, but the potential only cares about that distance. It doesn't care about the actual direction. This is one of the reasons why we're talking about potential. Remember, electric fields and forces involve directions, and directions are complicated in calculations, but it's a lot easier to just use scalar quantities, things like a distance, instead of something with a direction. So on slide 11, imagine that I have a system of discrete charges relative to a point P in space. If we now want to know what is the potential at point P in space, we can now calculate that as the sum of the potentials of the three of the charges, one, let's say they're N charges, one, two, dot, 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 N. The potential at point P is going to be the potential due to each of those charges, which means it's the sum of the potentials of each of those charges. So it'll just be the sum, where I have the Roman numeral 3, you can see the equation, it'll be the sum of the KQ over R's, where you now sum over the index I. So the ith charge will contribute a potential of KQ over R, KQ sub I over R sub I. Okay, so you look at this, what does that really mean? What that really means is that if I bring a charge from infinity and put it at point P, the work per unit charge it takes me to do that is this V sub P that we calculate in the equation delineated by the red box. The work per unit charge it takes to bring a charge in from infinity is equal to the work per unit charge, the sum of the work per unit charge it would take if I had only individual charges there. So it would be the work per unit charge it takes because of the presence of Q1, which would be KQ1 over R1. It's plus the work per unit charge it takes due to the presence of Q2, so KQ2 over R2, plus the work per unit charge it takes due to the presence of Q sub n, which would be KQ sub n over R sub n. This would be an expression, we would say this is the potential for a system of discrete charges. Go to slide 12. In a pattern that should be becoming quite familiar to you now, imagine that instead of a series of discrete charges, we have a series of a distribution, continuous distribution of charge. Now you might say, well, I don't know what to do. But what you do is you consider only a little portion, a little dq of that discrete, of that continuous distribution of charge. If we consider only a little portion dq, which we have on the upper left of slide 12, relative to point P, you can consider dq to be a discrete point charge. I know how to write the potential at point P due to that little dq. That is what I have written where you have a Roman numeral 3 on the right-hand side of slide 12. The potential at point P, which we call a differential potential, so I say dV sub P, it's differential because it's not a full Q but a little dQ that I'm considering. dV sub P is equal to K Q over R, but it's not Q because it's a DQ, so it's K DQ over R. So that would be the differential potential at point P due to this little charge DQ. How to think about that? That says that if I were to take a charge from out at infinity, where we've sort of defined the zero of potential, or the zero of potential energy, if you will, and I bring it all the way in and I put it at point P and I ask, how much energy per unit charge did it take to do that due to the presence of this little dq? The answer is it's kdq over r, where r is the distance from dq to p. So now to calculate the total potential it takes to move a charge from infinity, work per unit charge, to bring it to point P, due to this entire charge distribution, of which dq is just an infinitesimal little piece, then I have to sum over all the little dq's. So the total potential at point P is going to be the integral over the volume of all this charge of k dq over r. And that's what I have circled in the red box in the middle of slide 12. This would be the potential at point P due to this continuous charge distribution. So note a couple of things here. One is that kdq over r, it's a scalar. That means I don't worry about directionality. So remember that each of the dq's, as I integrate over this charge distribution, has a different direction with respect to P as the other DQs. So if it's an electric field, those calculations can be quite hard because that direction was important to consider. Here, I only need to worry about the distances, the magnitude of R. Also, when we do electric fields or forces, the force and electric fields, they depend as 1 over R squared. R squareds are more difficult to deal with than just R's. So, in a sense, most of the time, potential calculations are easier to do than electric field or force calculations because you don't have to worry about direction and it's 1 over R instead of 1 over R squared. So go to slide 13. Potential is work per unit charge, so the relationship is on the upper left, where Roman numeral 1. Let's imagine that, let me basically look at the differential aspect of both sides. So if potential is equal to work per unit charge, that means dV is equal to dW over Q, if I assume fixed Q. What is the change in energy if I move something a little bit? It's going to be the amount of work is going to be minus F dot ds. Thinking for a moment about how to make the minus sign make sense. Let me not worry about that at the moment. I think that comes out in the wash later. So a measure of the work would be F dot ds. And so if we look at the force per unit charge, that's basically what we define as the electric field. So maybe the minus sign makes sense. You imagine that I have a charge in space and I move a little charge Q a little bit toward it. So in that case, we'll come back to that. Just bear with me on the minus sign for a minute. So the force per unit charge is the electric field, so the differential potential is minus E dot ds. E dot ds is the same thing as the magnitude of E in the s direction times ds. So dV is equal to minus E sub s times ds, where E sub s is the component of the electric field in the s direction. Or another way to say it is the electric field along the s direction is minus the derivative of the potential with respect to the s direction. So this may seem sort of confusing. What does this really mean? What this does is it gives you a relationship between the energy and in terms of its potential and the electric field. So if you go to slide 14, here's why you care. You can get the electric field from the potential. S is a generic direction. If I want to know the electric field in direction S, I take the derivative of the potential function in that direction. What is the potential function? Well, we've just talked about how you can get the potential at every point in space by moving charges in from infinity and calculating the potential. So that is a scalar field. It's a scalar mapping on space of how the potential, the work per unit charge it takes to get to that point, may vary in space. So for a point charge, for example, it falls off as 1 over r. It's kq over r, just like we said. I can determine the electric field along a given direction by taking the derivative of that function minus the derivative. So this is important because we just discussed how sometimes the electric field is hard to calculate, because as you try to calculate it due to some distribution, you have to worry about the direction of each dq or each discrete q relative to the point where you're calculating the electric field, as well as the distance, and that quantity distance goes as 1 over r squared, so it's hard to calculate. The potential function, you're thinking about energy, it goes as 1 over r, and you don't have to worry about the direction, so it's often much simpler to think about. And then you can actually get the electric field in a given direction just by taking the derivative of that function. So life is often much simpler. So from the middle of slide 14 to the bottom of slide 15, I talk about how to do this in three dimensions. We're not going to do three-dimensional stuff with this in Physics 114, I promise to you that everything we do will be in along single dimension, so it'll be along the radius or along a direction x or whatever. So the only expression you really need to worry about is circled in the red by red on slide 14. That is, the electric field in a given direction is minus the derivative of the potential function with respect to that direction. If you have a three-dimensional problem, then it becomes a little more complicated. And sort of from the middle of slide 14, I'm going to say it fast. It's basically written here. If you're interested, you may look at this. If you're not interested, you can. We'll not worry about it till we get to slide 16. In three dimensions, the electric field is equal to E in the x in the I hat direction plus E in the y in the j hat direction plus E in the z in the k hat direction. So that would mean that if I want E in the x, I can take the derivative of the potential with respect to x minus the derivative of the potential with respect to x in the I hat direction. Similarly for j and k hat. The problem is, if it's a full three-dimensional problem, I can't just take an ordinary derivative along the direction x, because you also have y and z dependence. That means these derivatives become partial derivatives. So the expression sort of toward the bottom of slide 14 becomes the expression that you have at the slide on the slide at the top of 15, where you can get the full directionality, the full electric field, by taking the three partial derivatives shown in the expression at the top of slide 15. We define a vector operator, which we call del, which is also called the gradient, as the thing that's circled in red in the middle of slide 15. If I take that and I operate on the potential function, then you get the expression at the top of slide 15. And if you're familiar with partial derivatives, I give you an example function. Let's say the potential f, which is a function of f of x, which is a function of x, y, and z, is, say, e to the x times y squared times z cubed. And then we evaluate it using the expression at the top of slide 15, and that would be the electric field for that potential function. So it can be done in three dimensions. As I say in Physics 114, we will not worry about that. I thought some of you might find this interesting, so I just wanted to mention it. You may see in a textbook this symbology, this upside-down triangle, which is called the gradient or del in physics. And if you see it, this is basically what it is. We're not going to use it in this class. So again, just to iterate, in Physics 114, what you really need to know here is at the top of slide 14 that the electric field in a given direction is minus the derivative of the potential in respect to that direction. Okay. Just to mention the minus sign, I think the minus sign comes about a lot due to the kind of thinking we had earlier. If I have a positive charge, the electric field is actually going outward, and I do positive work by pushing something inward, and so there's sort of this difference in direction that pops out automatically if you have this minus sign using this thinking. I don't think it's worth worrying any more about it than that at the moment for us. So let's go to slide 16. And I want to pose a problem for you to think about. If you would, do not turn to slide 17 yet. I want you to think about this for a moment. Let's imagine that I have two spheres, two conducting spheres, and I connect them with a conducting wire. And let's now say that I deposit a large charge Q on this system. How does that charge Q get distributed around this system? I'd like you to pause this audio for a moment and think about that a little bit. See if you can tell me this charge Q, I deposit it, let's say, on the conductor, which has radius R2, which is bigger than R1. And let's say that charge then maybe redistributes itself around the system. How is that distribution done? That is, how much of this charge Q ends up on conducting ball of radius 1, and how much ends up on the conducting ball of radius 2. Think about that a bit. Take your best guess. I'll delay for a moment here. Pause the audio. Okay, if you've had a chance to think about it, now move on to slide 17. Let's talk about it. The conducting sphere with R2 is at the same potential as the conducting sphere of R1 because they're connected by a conductor. So it's all one conductor. That means the electric field in it is zero. So it takes no work to move charge from one piece to another. If I have charge on R1 and I have charge on R2, the potential, if I go to radius R1 for the charge that's at that radius, is KQ1 over R1. And the potential for charge at the radius R2, if I have a charge Q2 on that sphere, would be KQ2 over R2. Since those two are at the same potential, I know that KQ1 over R1 is equal to KQ2 over R2. So this means that the charge gets distributed proportional to the radius of these two things. So Q1 over Q2 goes as R1 over R2. And my guess is that's not what most of you said. Most of you probably would look at this problem and assume that the charge goes with the area. And that would mean that Q1 to Q2 would go as R1 squared to R2 squared, rather than as R1 to R2. So this is an example that sort of shows you the power of the potential in terms of thinking. Okay, so let's go to slide 18, the last slide. At the top, The potential at point P, if I have a given charge Q, depends on position only. So if I take a charge, I move it in from infinity, the work per unit charge it takes to bring it to that point P is KQ over R. Let's look in the middle of slide 18. Let us imagine that I take charge and I move it from point A to point B, where point A and point B are at the same radius. Since the work per unit charge, that is the potential it takes to come in from infinity, is the same for point A and point B, there is no change in potential going from point A to point B. That means the work per unit charge it takes me to go from A to B is zero. And it doesn't matter what path I take. I have several drawn here. That means that A and B are at the same potential, or that any point at that same radius, I would say, is at an equipotential. I say that these are lines. So these radials, these circles that are all where the points on each circle are at the same radius relative to point charge Q are lines of equipotential or lines of equal, but yeah, I think I said that, sorry, equipotential lines or lines of equal potential. So what that means is if I have a charge on one of those lines, I can move that charge all around that line at no work per unit charge, or no work does it take to do that. If I look at the potential difference between points C and D on the drawing, where I have Roman numeral 2, that would be KQ over D, which is the potential at point D, minus the potential at point C, which is KQ over R. Notice this is a difference in scalars, and so basically this is the calculation we did earlier. And so there is a net change in work there. So one thing to notice here is that the electric field lines for charge Q go out radially. So that means if I have a net change in the radial direction, there will be a net amount of work. So that's why there's a net amount of work between points C and D if I move a charge from one point to another, or a potential difference. But if I move at right angles to the electric field lines at all points along equipotential lines, then I can do that with no work at all. So that's why A and B, for example, are the same. Or the same potential, or along the same equipotential line. So just as you have visualized electric field lines in the past, basically by putting point charges from place to place and considering what is the direction of the force of the system on that point charge, and the direction of that net force being the direction of the electric field, here you also want to learn how to visualize the equipotential lines. And the equipotential lines will always be at right angles to the electric field line for the reasons that we've just stated. Okay, I think that's all I wanted to share with you today. I hope you've been able to listen to this and keep track of your questions, because next Tuesday, when I return to Rochester, we will probably discuss some of this again, and I want to try to address the questions that you might have. So I hope you're having a good week, and thank you for listening. Bye.